This is Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. As we approach Veterans Day 2021, let's pick up some topics about veterans and in particular about veterans health care. And the Veterans Health Administration has actually been around for 75 years, but in the decades just recently, including today, they have been able to keep up with the rather unique health care needs that veterans have from almost every era, going back that far, and they've been able to keep up with the advances in health care innovations as well. Let's find out more about the Veterans Health Administration from the Chief of Staff, John Jensen. John's an Army veteran. He's been in the Gulf Wars and Operation Iraqi Freedom, and he is now based out of Washington to keep a close eye on the VHA. And, John, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Well, thank you so much for having us. Sure appreciate the time.
Will you kind of explain briefly what the Department of Veterans Affairs has charged you and the VHA in doing?
Well, we develop a healthcare system that's focused specifically on veterans and veterans' needs. We understand veterans, we understand the needs that they have from their time in service, and we specialize in the illnesses, injuries, and ailments that may have been caused during that time. Mm-hmm. We also are veterans. Nearly one-third of the nearly 380,000 employees dedicated to caring for our veterans are veterans themselves, and that means in many cases that veterans are caring for veterans. Hey, every day at the VA is Veterans Day, and we ensure that everyone should know that we are one of the best healthcare systems in the country. They were continually ranked that way, and veterans should know that.
One of probably the simple questions that could be asked, I suppose, of anybody working with the VHA is, why should veterans go to the VA hospital or the VA healthcare clinics rather than going to a private doctor? What's the general reason why VA is almost always a serious choice for healthcare?
Well, we specialize in the needs of veterans and the time in service. But we do that through a kind of a specific, holistic, whole health approach to care, mm-hmm. Where we do that in a team-based model. We call that a patient-aligned care team. As a primary care provider, a nurse case manager, mental health provider, social worker, and others that are wrapping around the veteran and what they need. And we focus on what matters to veterans, not just what is the matter. We're able to reach in so many different ways to the veterans' concerns and them. In their home, in their community, and obviously with their health care. But I think something that not a lot of people know is that 70% of all health care providers in this country actually receive training in the VA. And my bet is that your provider probably received some training in the VA. And that means that we have the best and the brightest and continually look for ways to reach our veterans.
Does that seem to be one of the best ways why VA does differ from the private sector healthcare industry? And as you mentioned just now, that the VA healthcare providers are often ones that go on to other positions, maybe in the private sector, but they always seem to come back to the VA.
Yes, they do, and we are so happy and proud to have great partnerships throughout our academic affiliates to ensure that we get to get the best and the brightest in our facilities. 97% of all medical schools in this country actually partner with the VA, and then many of our providers are dual response at the academic affiliate as well as in the VA, and that's pretty special.
When you mentioned earlier about the fact that the Veterans Health Administration focuses primarily, of course, on veterans, and they've specialized that way because they've been able to know how to take care of veterans, what are some of the innovative approaches that the VA has been able to do over the years to keep up with things as things have changed, unfortunately, as veterans come back from overseas in combat camps and the like? They may have suffered certain problems that maybe their predecessors in past wars, past conflicts, didn't have.
Yeah, well, we're a world leader on many, many fronts when it comes to medical research. PTSD, traumatic brain injury, some of those things are that we're world leaders in and actually consult on with other countries and obviously other medical facilities. We've been on the forefront of research and innovation since our inception, and we will continue to do so. We're one of the largest research organizations in the world, and that's where it should be in my mind as we care for veterans. We were some of the first to develop many things, including the first liver transplant was done in the VA. The first implantable pacemaker was done in the VA. We helped in the development of the CAT scan. And today, through 3D printing, we're actually able to provide fitting, research, as well as the actual production of prosthesis so veterans can receive those same day. And that's, again, right where we should be in my mind.
Is it something that most people don't recognize, the fact that the VA has done an awful lot of research and a lot of the innovations that maybe have gone into the private sector have come out of the research that the VA system has done?
Yeah, it's amazing to know the amount of research that happens here. And we have some dedicated researchers at almost all of our facilities that partner with academic affiliates in the country, from there in Chicago, Northwestern Medical School, that they're there, but so many other places where we partner with those organizations to develop research, to look at a new and better way of caring for our veterans. And again, that's right where we should be in my mind. We should always be looking for new and better ways of caring for our veterans. And I'll tell you, that also bleeds out. That research helps everyone, not just veterans. That research goes into helping every human in America.
Have you found that the way the VA has been able to cope with the changes, evolve with the changes, to be, I suppose, more accurate, about the change in equitable health care, and in particular to women veterans and to veterans of color? Now, of course, veterans of color seem to have always been within the system, even going back to World War II. We know for sure that there were specific veterans of colors in units that came back from combat, and they had to be cared for when they got back home.
Yes, one of our fastest-growing cohorts of veterans is women veterans. Since 2001, the number of women veterans coming into our facilities for care has tripled to almost 550,000 today, and that means we need to focus specialized care on those veterans to understand what their needs are and ensure that we're providing a response to those needs. For an example, early on in the pandemic, when we were developing actually the vaccine, we outreached to communities of color to find out what their concerns were as we talked about the vaccine. We outreached to them, we had discussions, we answered questions, and today African-American and Hispanic veterans actually have received the vaccine at higher rates than our Caucasian veterans have. So we continue to look for ways to ensure that everyone should know that the care that they get in the VA and what they do in our VA is to treat them with respect and compassion, just like everyone should be treated with.
Now, if we have a veteran that is listening to our conversation and is not been involved in signing up for VA health care through the Veterans Health Administration, what do veterans have to do? What's some of the first steps that they have, and what will they find when they make it over to that local clinic?
Well, they can, of course, just go to their local clinic and find the a sign up. But you can also go to va.gov, and you can go on our webpage, and it helps you to find the facility that's closest to you. You can reach out to them and provide the information that's required. When you leave service, you're given what's called a DD-214. That just helps to denote that you have been in service, and then we basically take care of the rest of that. So we can help any veteran to sign up. They just reach out to us at va.gov, and we will help them to sign up for care. And we want the VA to be the healthcare system of choice for our veterans.
You mentioned about the opportunities to sign up here. What kind of feedback do you get from veterans that maybe have not experienced the VA healthcare system before? They've found how easy it is to become part of the system and the kind of healthcare that they get. What kind of response do you get from these folks?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, a lot of people don't realize that we are listed as one of the best healthcare systems in the country. And I think when a veteran comes to see us, that they'll find that that's the case. Also find that when you come to our facilities, you're going to see other veterans there. Every veteran from every era. And the discussions that happen in our waiting rooms are pretty special. And I wish every listener would be able to sit and listen to those conversations. But it's, rekindling friendships, reminding of their time in service, pride for their specific branch of service is also pretty unique. And so when you come to the VA, that's what you're a part of. You're a part of a community, as I mentioned, of veterans, not only those receiving care, but those providing care in many cases. And I think that that's extremely important.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, that every day is Veterans Day, certainly with the Veterans Health Administration. Are there any special commemorations or thoughts that they happen to pass along on Veterans Day when it comes up here this week?
Well, one of the things happening here in Washington, D.C. is the ceremony at Arlington, 100 years of the Tomb of the Unknown. And so that's some special times here happening in Washington, D.C. I know there's lots of great celebrations happening throughout the rest of the country. And so it's a good time for those that maybe not a veteran to thank a veteran for their service and for their sacrifice. It's important. It's what makes our country great. And we cannot thank our veterans enough, in my mind.
John Jensen is the Chief of Staff for the Veterans Health Administration. The Veterans Health Administration has been around for 75 years, and it's keeping up with the times, as it has to help deal with the health care needs of veterans from every single era of service. And, John, thank you very much for what you mentioned today, and I hope that the VA health system will continue to grow and do the things that make veterans proud to have served their country.
Thank you so much, and happy Veterans Day.
$47 billion in the federal infrastructure bill will go to make communities in the country more resilient to natural events like flooding, drought, and extreme heat. The White House says that it's the largest such investment in American history. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us that an IUPUI researcher says that the measure is a very good first step.
Gabriel Filippelli is the director of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. He says money from the infrastructure bill could go toward a number of projects in Indiana, like making better flood protection maps and identifying urban heat islands and ways to mitigate them. But last year alone, the U.S. suffered almost $100 billion worth of damage from extreme weather and climate-related disasters. Funding from the infrastructure bill would only be half that much and spread out over 10 years, not one.
No, it's not enough in the long run, just because it pales in comparison to the climate costs, climate disaster costs. But it's better than nothing, and it's a great first step.
And Filippelli says resilience will only go so far. The U.S. has to stop burning fossil fuels. Otherwise, the future may be worse than what we're prepared for. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A Purdue University mechanical engineering professor and his team is working on a way to perhaps eliminate air conditioning in buildings in warm weather climates forever. In an effort to curb global warming, he and his team have created the whitest white acrylic paint, which reflects 98.1% of sunlight and deflects infrared heat, allowing buildings to cool beyond and below the surrounding air temperatures. Purdue podcast producer Katie Young spoke with him, and he shared his surprise at the amount of attention that the inventions received, not only in the engineering and the science worlds, but also in the art space. Plus, he breaks down how this paint can actually help people save money on their electric bills.
Shulin Ruan is a professor of mechanical engineering at Purdue University. His giant leap as a boilermaker, inventing the whitest paint on record in an effort to curb global warming. We'll get more into the paint's effect on climate, but one of the most interesting things Shulin shared with me, when the team first started this project, they didn't actually set out to create the whitest white paint.
When we started the project about 7 years ago, we had the energy savings and fighting climate change in mind.
That's right. This invention is 7 years in the making. Shulin explains.
We started working on this in 2014. You know, we tested many different materials, concentrations, and the different particle sizes and so on. So it does take a lot of effort, and many students who graduated and then new students continued the effort to really make it happen. So using radio cooling in paints really started in the 1960s. At that time, people were trying to create, you know, white paint that can reflect the sunlight as much as they can. And at the same time, we know any surfaces, when you put on the roof, they're going to emit their own heat to the surrounding as well. So the problem was that at that time, the whitest paint they people created can reflect 80 to 90% of sunlight, which means they absorb 10 to 20% of the sunlight. So that's still too much heat absorbed from the sunlight, and that's more than the heat they lose. So although they are cooler than the other colored paints, they cannot be cooled below the ambient temperature. You know, a few years back, we started on this, first inspired by a group at the Stanford University, which created multi-layer nanostructures that can do below ambient cooling, but was very expensive, not viable for buildings. So we went ahead and think about, you know, whether we can create the paints to be below the ambient temperature, because we had much better nanotechnology than half a century ago. So we eventually came up with this new paint formula, you know, with a few innovations compared to the commercial white paints.
This new whitest white acrylic paint reflects 98.1% of sunlight, compared with the 95.5% of sunlight reflected by the team's previous ultra white paint. It deflects infrared heat, allowing buildings to cool below the surrounding air temperature. In fact, the team's tests have shown that the paint is able to keep a surface around 8 degrees cooler than its ambient temperature in the afternoon, and up to 19 degrees cooler at night. But what makes this paint the coolest? A very high concentration of a chemical compound called barium sulfate. It's also used to make photo paper and cosmetics white. Barium sulfate was used in the paint in pigment particles of various sizes, which allows the paint to scatter more of the light spectrum from the sun. But the barium sulfate used had to be just the right amount. If they used a higher concentration of this, it would likely cause the paint to break or peel off, according to the research team. Xu Lin walks us through how this new paint differs from commercial paint you can go buy at a local hardware store.
Tell us about what's in the paint. How is this different from if you go to the store and buy a regular can of paint?
It has a few key innovations compared to the commercial white paints you can buy. I mean, that took us a long time to figure out actually each aspect, each innovation over the years. Now, first, the commercial white paints are based on titanium dioxide. So titanium dioxide reflects very well in the visible portion and near infrared portion of the sunlight, but it absorbs the UV. So we first went out to look for materials that would not absorb UV at all. That those included oxides, carbonates, and sulfates. So those were our candidates. But that's not sufficient. We came to realize that we need a much higher concentration in the commercial paints. So commercial paints, they usually have less than 10% of the particle loading, and that's not sufficient to reflect sunlight for the energy purpose. So we tested different particle loading, and eventually landed at 60%. And it's appropriate number to sufficiently reflect and scatter sunlight. At the same time, it still behaves like a paint. So a third key innovation that really pushed our paint to the performance we see today is not using a uniform size. That's kind of a little bit counterintuitive at the beginning, but our predictions showed us eventually if you use a single size, it only reflects one wavelength of the sunlight really well, not the other wavelengths. So once you have different particle size in your paint, each size will be responsible to reflect one wavelength in the sunlight. So eventually, the whole spectrum of sunlight can be reflected effectively. So these are the three key differences from the commercial paints. I can summarize again. First is a material that does not absorb UV. Second, high particle concentration. Third, non-uniform particle sizes.
Throughout Xu Lin's journey with creating this paint and pushing the limits on their previous white paint, of course, came with challenges and roadblocks. The team had considered over 100 different materials, narrowed them down to 10, and tested about 50 different formulations for each material.
To be honest, 7 years ago, we didn't, know that we would achieve such great reflectance today. So we did run into a lot of roadblocks, and then, but we're really happy that working with our students, postdocs, we were able to overcome these challenges, and that led us to arrive where we are today. So each innovation actually came out of the challenges we were facing. For example, at the beginning, we were trying to push the titanium dioxide that is used in commercial paints to perform very well. So we made many different trials based on titanium dioxide, different particle loading, different substrate. We at that time, we didn't believe we were able to achieve this in a single layer. So we tried putting these materials into a two-layer structure and so on. So after many trials, we were not able to get cooling below the ambient temperature, and then we came to realize it's the materials problem. So that's how we set out to look for other materials like barium sulfate, calcite, and so on. But even with that, we tested many materials, maybe as many as 100 materials. Some materials, we kind of expected them to work, but it didn't work eventually. We also had a hard time on the matrix material, like polymer to use. Some of the particle fillers, they don't really like the polymer. I mean, we're not able to disperse them so well in the polymer matrix or binders. So we kind of explore that to find the good pair of the filler as well as the polymer to have a good dispersion. We came to realize, the particle concentration was not high enough. So we tested many particle concentration. And the last maybe challenge I want to highlight is that after we've done all these, we were trying to explain the performance, why it is 98.1%. So using previous models, we are not able to match the prediction with our experimental data. To be more specific, the theory says that reflectance should be lower than the experimental measurements. And, we spend time on that and eventually find out that that's because we have different particle size in it. Previously people just neglect the non-uniformity in the size. And we found that it plays a very important role increasing your reflectance from just above 90 now to 98.1%. So I have to say that, the innovations were pushed by the challenges we were facing. And that's how the science and engineering works.
I love that quote. The innovations were pushed by the challenges we were facing, and that's how science and engineering works. As Boilermakers, Shu Lin and his team continued in their persistent pursuit of making this paint a reality.
This Purdue podcast producer, Katie Young, with mechanical engineering professor Shu Ruan. We have special Veterans Day programming on the program tomorrow, and we'll be back with you on Monday.